One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today. And get your old self back naturally.
I'm Kathy with a C.
And I'm Kathy with a K.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Boulder, Colorado. The city is located along the foothills of the Rocky Mountains in northern Colorado, and archaeological evidence shows that Boulder Valley has been continuously inhabited by Native American tribes for over 13,000 years. Historians believe that indigenous peoples moved seasonally between the mountains and the plains, taking shelter in winter along the Front Range Trough where Boulder now lies. The city is an outdoor paradise, with nature enthusiasts taking advantage of its 300 days of sunshine each year, 46,000 acres of open space, and an abundance of recreational activities. There are miles of hiking and biking trails, world-class rock climbing, and easy access to nearby ski resorts. Boulder has been consistently recognized over the years as one of the best places in the nation to live, work, play, and visit. And U.S. News and World Report has named it the best place to live and the seventh safest place to live in the United States. But in 1994, the town of Boulder did not seem like a safe place when one family lost its patriarch. And 3 decades later, residents discovered that the murder wasn't the only thing they needed to be afraid of.
At the beginning of November 1994, a murder in Boulder, Colorado shocked the city. 48-year-old Marty Grisham, an 18-year employee with the city who served as Boulder's Director of Information Systems, was pronounced dead at Boulder Community Hospital. That night, he had been having dinner at his apartment with his new girlfriend, Barbara, when someone knocked on the door. When he went to the door to open it, he first looked through the peephole. He then turned around and, with a strange look on his face, stared directly at Barbara, but didn't say a word. He just opened the door. When he did so, he was shot 4 times, twice in the chest and twice in the head. Neighbors who heard the shots called 911 and were able to revive him while they waited for police and paramedics. Despite their heroic efforts, sadly, Marty Grisham died at the hospital a short time later. Marty was a University of Colorado graduate and had served in his current position as the Director of Information Systems for more than 13 years. And, Kath, he'd already made plans to retire. He had planned to only stay on the job for 9 more months. Now, as word of Marty's death got out, Boulder City Manager Tim Honey said that Marty was an outstanding public servant, and words really couldn't even begin to describe what he meant to the Boulder community.
Small side note, my dad went to the University of Colorado for a while.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I figured you didn't, but he...
He's been hiding it from me this whole time?
Exactly.
Well, or have you?
He took a very circuitous route to becoming an attorney, as you know.
Yes, like that I do know.
Truck driver, teacher, construction worker, taxi driver. But University of Colorado was his second university. So he got kicked out. Yeah, for poor academics. But he loved it.
Wait, and you got in trouble for bad grades in high school and he got kicked out of college for it?
Yeah, I only got talked to one time and that time I deserved it. But anyway,
and it was math. I remember that one.
Yeah, but well, I had to take it over during the summer. But for the most part, my parents did not like...
You guys all did well.
...oversee academics. But anyway, yeah, so my dad got kicked out. But here's the funny thing. So he tells me this when I was younger, like I was probably in high school when he tells me this. But he, now at the age of 88, denies it. Isn't that funny?
I love that.
I know.
So we get to rewrite history when we get older.
Oh, totally.
Love that.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's start now.
He started his college career at St. Mary's. He got kicked out of St. Mary's.
Is that the one in Minnesota?
Yeah. And so
That's the Catholic one in Minnesota.
Okay, so this is the funny thing. Like every so often it comes up. I'm talking like once every 5 years somehow, like whatever. And my mom's like, oh, Kathy, you're crazy. Your father did not get kicked out of St. Mary's. But I remember the story. He said that when he was a freshman had a curfew in the dorm, and there was this priest that oversaw everybody who was apparently terrifying. And so my dad comes home and he doesn't care that he's late. And so this priest comes up to him and like puts his fist into a ball like he's going to hit my dad. And I guess my dad said something like, Father, you better watch out. I will hit back. Like he was not, you know, anyone to be trifled with. He just didn't want to be bossed around. At 88, he still doesn't want to be bossed around.
Nothing's changed.
Exactly. Yeah. So I guess my grandma got a call and was like, come get your kid.
Wow.
Yeah. And then ultimately he finished college. He got like a football scholarship at Parsons, a small college in Iowa that I don't even think exists anymore. From the beginning, police had little to go on to track down Marty's killer. No one had seen the gunman, including Marty's date, Barbara, and there were no immediate suspects or motives in the case. The only clue they had was that one resident of the apartment complex had seen a strange man walking toward Marty's apartment around 9:15 on the night of the murder. Something about the man had just set off her radar as she passed him on her way to the laundry room. So, Kath, this lady went down to the police station and sat down with a sketch artist to create a composite sketch of the man that she saw, but unfortunately, it didn't generate any leads. And during the initial investigation, detectives discovered that on the day Marty was murdered, he filed a police report just that morning. He told the police that his apartment had been burglarized and that a book of checks had been missing since October 11th. So this is just 3 weeks before the murder. And he told police the name of the man who he thought took his checks. So just a few days after Marty Grisham's murder, Boulder police announced the arrest of 19-year-old Michael Clark on felony charges. In the 3 weeks from the time he stole the checkbook up until Marty's murder, he had cashed $4,500 worth of checks. So, Kath, it turned out that Michael Clark was friends with Marty's daughter, Kristen, and police learned that Kristen had given Michael the key to her dad's apartment. And this was so Michael could feed Marty's cats when he was out of town. In looking into Michael's background, police also learned that he owned a 9mm gun, which was the same caliber used in Marty's murder. But Michael told detectives when he was interviewed that he really didn't know any details about the gun. He'd gotten the gun from his friend Dion, but he didn't know what happened to it. At the time, Michael Clark pleaded guilty to theft and forgery for stealing and using Marty's checks. However, he insisted he was not involved in his death, and a city spokesman said there was no information at the time connecting Michael to the murder. They said detectives were looking into every lead, but soon the case went cold.
Okay, Cass, so here's what's interesting, though. More than 2 years later, with Marty Grisham's murder still unsolved, the case got even colder when the world's attention was focused on a different murder in Boulder, Colorado, a murder that we actually covered about 7 weeks ago. This, of course, was the gruesome murder of young beauty queen JonBenet Ramsey. With the Boulder police again in the spotlight, local reporters were, of course, like, hey, by the way, what happened to Marty's unsolved case? To which they responded that they were still hopeful that new information would lead them to an arrest. And then JonBenet's murder also became another unsolved death that the police couldn't solve. Now, Boulder wasn't the only Colorado city at the time that had a plethora of unsolved cases. And in July 2007, government did what government does best. The state passed legislation to create a cold case team at the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and this included a cold case task force and a cold case database. However, while legislation created these tools to help bring closure to the families of murder victims, the legislature would not provide the funding to pay for any of these programs.
So it was just more virtue signaling.
Government doing what government does best.
Exactly.
In response, after being denied the funding, in 2009, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, or the CBI, launched a statewide group that included members of various law enforcement branches, and they included police detectives, coroners, and prosecutors. And so these were not funded, obviously, by the state. It wasn't an official task force, but rather all of the different agencies were providing manpower on a strictly voluntary basis to try and help bring some closure across the state.
I can appreciate that.
Absolutely.
You know, and $10 says they had like retired homicide detectives and things like that.
Hopefully.
I bet you anything.
Yeah. The group started holding regular meetings to try and finally solve some of these cold case murders. And by including law enforcement branches from across the state, they hoped that it would now provide new insight into crimes that had languished for years because you had people who didn't know anything about the case who were looking at it. And after forming this cold case task force, just 3 years later, the Boulder police announced an arrest in Marty Grisham's murder.
In January 2012, more than 17 years after Marty was murdered, Boulder detectives arrested Michael Clark at his home in Summit County, about 80 miles southwest of Boulder, where he lived with his wife and three young children. So this is obviously the guy who pled guilty to stealing Marty's checks, you know, 17 years prior.
The one who was friends with Marty's daughter, Kristen.
Exactly. And how old was he at the time?
19.
And Kath, as part of the plea, he was given probation. That's for the thievery back when.
Never served time.
Correct. According to an article in the Daily Camera by Erica Meltzer, the arrest warrant affidavit alleged the evidence against Michael included statements he made to a cellmate in the Boulder County Jail after he was arrested for stealing checks 17 years prior.
If he's not testifying, is he technically a snitch yet?
I think so. The arrest warrant also alleged that Michael made statements to Dion. This is the friend of his who helped him buy the gun, okay? And supposedly, at the time they were purchasing the gun, Michael told Dion he was worried about being caught for check fraud.
And of course, the obvious implication is that Michael wanted the gun to kill Marty so that Marty couldn't testify against him for check fraud.
3 months after Michael, now 36 years old, was arrested, he pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder.
And Kath, the bond for the murder charge was actually set at just $100,000. Obviously, this is a lot lower than we usually hear about for murder suspects, but the judge at the time said that the fact that Michael Clark knew he was under investigation for months and yet still made no attempt to flee, and that he had not been arrested on any offenses since pleading guilty to forgery and theft in the aftermath of Marty Grisham's killing, made a lower bond appropriate.
Which meant he just had to come up with 10 grand.
Exactly. But apparently, facing a first-degree murder charge maybe rattled him a little bit too much. Because after being given this low bond and bonding out quickly, just 1 month later, Michael Clark was arrested for DUI. According to another article in the Daily Camera by Erica Meltzer, this was in February of 2012, Michael was pulled over and subsequently arrested after police received a call from Michael's probation officer. Now, Kath, what happened is the probation officer called police and said, Michael just left my office after a meeting and yet he was toasted. He could have said lit or hammered, but I'm just thinking toasted. You know.
Exactly. Why was he going to some type of probation officer?
Kath, from what I understand, as a condition of having the slower bond, he was required to meet on regular intervals with a probation officer. When police pulled Michael over, he had, you know, all the usual things that go along with drunk driving. Like he was moving slowly, his speech was off, his eyes were all red, watery, whatnot. He actually was given a breathalyzer test, but the results were never made public. However, according to the arresting officer, Michael admitted that he drank good-sized shots of whiskey and gin and tonics at midnight, again at 3 a.m. and again at 6 a.m., and then left his home in Summit County. Remember, this is about 80 miles away from Boulder. Left his home at 8 a.m. to drive to the meeting with his probation officer. Wise choices all.
Yeah, I would not ever mix whiskey and gin. That's what I'm saying about that.
If only he knew you then.
I'm not a G&T kind of gal.
I'm not either.
I do like whiskey.
I don't either.
I do.
I'm a tequila shot kind of person.
And I am a dirty martini girl.
So Michael goes to the meeting with his probation officer. The probation officer calls the cops. Michael gets pulled over and he tells the police about his drinking schedule the night before. Or at least the prior 12 hours.
Right.
He also told police, Kathy, that he had a clear plastic water bottle in the car that he had filled with gin and tonic. But as I wrote this, I said, but said he didn't drink it. But the actual quote was, he told police he didn't suck on it while he was driving. So he may have sucked on it later.
Right.
But not while he was
exactly.
driving.
Exactly.
So in addition to his $100,000 bond for murder, he was given a $1,000 bond for this drunk driving incident. He paid a $1,000 bond and was released from jail later that same night. I'm assuming once he sobered up.
I would assume the same. Trial began in October 2012, almost 18 years after Marty Grisham was killed when he answered a knock at his front door. Detectives testified that when they reopened the case in 2009, 15 years later, they had been able to find additional evidence that, while circumstantial, they believe conclusively linked Michael to the crime. Before Michael was arrested and when the case was reopened, he was interviewed by federal agents. So this is about a year before the trial took place. And he said that he got a 9mm gun from his friend Dion, but he didn't remember how long he'd had the gun or what happened to it. He actually told agents he may have dumped it in a dumpster in Denver, but he wasn't sure. So what the agents testified to was that they went and spoke with Dion, the buddy, and Dion said, "Yeah, I asked a guy to go into a pawn shop and get these guns, one for me, one for Michael." And so that's how we have these 9mm. But to police, this stood out because it was a different story than what Michael had told them back in 1994. So what he said back in 1994 was that he got the gun because a stranger had left it in his car.
You know, I've had that happen so many times. I can't even count.
I cannot stand it.
I know.
So, Kath, in 1994, after having the gun dropped into his car by some unknown stranger, he told police back then that he then gave the gun away
to like this random person he saw in Denver.
Right.
Could you imagine walking down the street and some guy being like, "Here, take this."
Exactly. The whole point is police are searching for the murder weapon. They don't have the murder weapon. They're trying to track it down. They're trying to connect murder weapons to Michael. Ultimately, they go back to the pawn shop. They look at the records for the gun's sales and they find the guy who bought the gun. And they're like, "Knock, knock. By the way, do you remember 17 years ago, somebody coming up to you and asking you to purchase two handguns?" And he was like, "Yes."
And do you remember exactly what he looked like?
Exactly. And so,
and he said yes to that too.
He matches the description of Dion. So the investigator's like, "Aha, we have Dion purchasing this gun from this man who remembers what Dion looked like 17 years ago. And then we have Dion giving the gun to Michael.
And we have the pawn shop records that say it was a Bryco Jennings 9mm. So they know the manufacturer of the 9mm gun.
Exactly. So on the stand, two Colorado Bureau of Investigation ballistics experts testified that without the gun to compare the shells and bullets found at the scene, the best they could do was narrow down the makes and models of the guns that could possibly have fired rounds. So the CBI ballistics showed that a Bryco Jennings gun was one possibility, but they could not say for certain the murder weapon was a Bryco Jennings gun. So this whole big lot of testimony about the guns that they never identified as being the murder weapon,
or as ever being in the possession of Michael or Dion.
That's true. They could not prove that Michael was in possession of this gun.
Right.
Even if this guy actually, in fact, remembered it was Dion 17 years later, like maybe Dion's really, really good looking and hard to forget.
Or really bad looking and hard to forget.
Exactly. Anyway, even if this guy remembered Dion, it doesn't mean there was any connection to Michael. So we just wasted 10 minutes of your time and we are really sorry.
As all of you know, anybody who's listened to us for more than one case, which all of you have and downloaded.
Thank you for downloading.
No good murder case is complete without what, Kath?
A jailhouse snitch.
Exactly. And because we would never want to disappoint you, we got one of those as well. According to an October 2012 article in the Daily Camera by Mitchell Byers, an inmate who shared a cell with Michael Clark shortly after Marty Grisham was killed in 94 said Michael talked about the shooting and confirmed that he shot Marty. So here's what happened, Kath. The snitch is a man named Walter Stackhouse.
Stackhouse is in the big house.
So the snitch was in the Boulder County Jail with Michael when Michael was in there for the check fraud charges. Again, 17 years prior to the trial that's happening now for murder. Now, Stackhouse testified that while he and Michael were in the same cell, they began to talk about the shooting investigation. And Stackhouse testified that Michael said to him, "They think I killed somebody." And Stackhouse said, "What?" And Michael had replied to him, "That's what they think." So Stackhouse testified that when he asked Michael if he, in fact, had shot somebody, Stackhouse actually said on the stand, Kathy, that Michael appeared to nod. When Stackhouse was asked, did Michael ever actually admit that he shot Marty Grisham? He said, you know, Michael didn't really say anything. He just sort of nodded his head. And then, according to Stackhouse, Michael said, "The guy is dead," and didn't say anything after that. But Kathy, you know what's really interesting, though, about this is that Stackhouse said that in 94, he went to the jail officials and said, "Hey, I got information about a murder case." And yet it took 17 years for them to actually prosecute Michael.
Yeah, so we have no idea in 1994 whether Stackhouse actually spoke to anybody, or he could have been a footnote in a police file that the cold case unit was like, "Hey, who's this guy?
Let's talk to him a little more."
Yeah, we just don't know.
Right.
One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally. Oh, oh,
oh, O'Reilly. Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today. Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Auto parts. So up to this point, all of the evidence presented was circumstantial. There was nothing specifically linking Michael Clark to the crime.
And Kathy, remember the person who lived in the apartment complex who did a composite sketch?
Right.
Looked nothing like Michael Clark.
Oh,
so
really?
They were not brought to the stand.
They're like, "You stay home, Missy."
Exactly.
Yeah.
"We'll call you if you're needed."
And of course, the gun was never found.
And the make of the model may or may not have been the gun.
Exactly. And of course, there's, you know, the jailhouse snitch.
Enough said.
Right. But then prosecutors brought Yvonne Woods to the stand, who went by Missy. And she, for decades, was considered a top DNA analyst at the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. She testified that she tested a small container of Carmex lip balm. She testified the small container of Carmex that had been found outside of Marty Grisham's apartment the day after he was shot. Missy Woods testified that DNA testing was not available in 1994 in Colorado when the shooting occurred. But when the case was reopened, Boulder police sent in the container to be examined for DNA. Missy Woods was able to recover some DNA from inside the jar and testified that the sample was degraded, but there was one major male contributor. And when the DNA profile was extracted and compared to Michael Clark, it was a partial match. Missy testified that the test excluded 99.4% of the population, but Michael Clark was included in the 0.6% of the population who could have been the killer. On October 22, 2012, after 3 days of deliberation, Michael Clark was found guilty. He was sentenced to life in prison, which was the mandatory sentence in Colorado for first-degree murder. And after the verdict, prosecutor Ryan Brackley said, "I'm deeply satisfied that the collaboration between the Boulder Police Department, the DA's office, the FBI, ATF, and CBI paid off with a verdict that was just, and obviously the work of a very hardworking jury." Several appeals were denied. Then in 2019, Michael Clark's new attorney, Adam Frank, filed a motion to overturn his conviction. Part of his argument was that DNA expert Missy Wood's testimony should have been more closely challenged by the public defender who represented Michael at trial. And as part of his filing, Attorney Frank included an affidavit from another DNA expert who sharply criticized Ms. Wood's conclusions and her testimony. He called it oversimplified, incomplete, and misleading. His expert said that, at best, Ms. Wood's interpretations were inconclusive. At worst, they were inaccurate.
But it would be 4 years before Michael Clark had any hope that there was a chance his appeal would be granted. In 2023, 12 years after Michael was convicted of first-degree murder, largely based on the DNA evidence, the CBI admitted that it had discovered more than 650 cases between 2008 and 2023 that had been affected by data manipulation of DNA evidence. And the person doing the manipulation was Missy Woods. According to a June 2024 article in the Denver Post by Shelley Bradbury, an internal CBI report obtained by the newspaper showed that the Colorado Bureau of Investigation allowed Missy Woods to stay on the job for years, despite repeated concerns about the quality and reliability of her work. Now, Kath, according to the report, the agency's inaction allowed Ms. Woods to continue to mishandle DNA testing for nearly a decade after a colleague of hers first raised the alarm in 2014. It wasn't until an intern rediscovered problems in 2023 and a subsequent investigation called nearly all of Missy Woods' 3 decades of work into question. This internal report found that Missy Woods cut corners in the DNA testing and then actually covered them up by altering, deleting, omitting the data from her lab work. She also omitted any relevant facts from criminal justice records. And Kath, in some cases, she even tampered with DNA testing by omitting some test results. At this point, and this again is in 2023 after this report has been done, the CBI requested $3 million from state legislators so that they could retest 3,000 DNA samples through a third-party lab. And then they also sought another $4.4 million so that DA offices across Colorado could pay out claims of people who said they were wrongly convicted because of Missy Wood's manipulated results.
Unbelievable.
So, Kath, in this article, Ms. Wood's colleagues raised concerns about her work, first in 2014, as we said, again in 2018, and then again in 2023. And in this internal investigation, the colleagues all said that Missy Woods was the golden child of the agency. All of the managers thought that she was top-notch. They trusted her. They gave her all of the really high-profile, important cases at the agency. But despite management's opinion of her, her reputation among her colleagues was that she cut corners in her work in order to stay on top so that she was still doing the most work. Her managers all saw her as being the most productive, you know, all of this sort of thing. And so in this internal investigation, these colleagues outlined several incidents over the years that basically raised doubt about her work, but never actually led to any sort of penalty against her or her removal from the job.
That is totally unbelievable.
So basically, Kath, in 2014, Missy Woods was reported for cutting corners and, you know, sloppy work, deleting things. Her supervisor just said, hey, I need you to go fix this. And nothing ever happened to her as a result of it. And then after a colleague complained again in 2018, Missy's manager said, you know what, it's a mental health issue. She's working a ton of overtime. We need to help her. We need to be here for her. So Missy Woods was temporarily removed from the casework. She attended counseling. And when she returned from the job, she was not allowed to do any overtime for an entire month. So this internal review that happened now in 2023 said that at the time that all of these kind of slaps on the wrist were happening, the pattern of her larger manipulation of cases was totally missed because they were just focusing on like one in 2014, one in 2018, one in 2023. They weren't looking at, okay, if these are problems, what's been going on this whole time?
Right. They're just looking at them as though they're anomalies rather than patterns.
That was exactly it. In November 2023, Ms. Woods sat down with the internal investigators and she admitted that she had deleted data about low quantities of male DNA in some sexual assault cases, especially cases from the Denver police, is what she said. But she said she did it because she didn't want to have to complete additional testing that was unlikely to produce any other results because the quantity of DNA was so low.
Like in a rape case or something, she's like, sorry, there's no DNA.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Yeah. She also said that by deleting the DNA, it allowed her to complete cases faster because, remember, she was the top one. She was being given all these things simply because she wouldn't have to continue doing any troubleshooting on the DNA that was coming up that wasn't fitting the patterns that she wanted it to fit. She also told investigators that she also did it in sexual assault cases because it was easy, and admitted that she also did it in sex assault cases because she may have wanted to avoid questions from defense attorneys when they asked about why additional testing on the deleted samples was not done.
So, Kath, even though Missy said, hey, I only did this in sex assault cases, her colleague said, oh, no, no, and they cast a doubt on that claim, implying there were more serious cases out there, i.e. murder. In the summer of 2018, a colleague told investigators that she caught Ms. Woods manipulating DNA results in the case of Alex Ewing, the so-called hammer killer, who was convicted of murdering three Aurora family members and a Jefferson County woman in 1984. DNA was used to tie him to the crime scene decades after the killing. The colleague said Ms. Woods gave her the case around 2:30 p.m. on a Friday and demanded that the results come in by the end of the day. But her coworker found evidence of contamination in the DNA samples, which would have required additional steps in their analysis. According to the internal investigation, Ms. Woods then deleted data to make the sample appear uncontaminated. So this colleague confronted Ms. Woods and basically told her, like, yo, sister, I am not signing off on this work. I'm pretty sure I'm quoting her.
I assume that was true.
Exactly. Then this colleague reported the incident to two supervisors, including CBI's assistant director of quality for forensic services. Later, Ms. Woods told this whistleblower that she had completed the extra work on the case and that she just wasn't thinking clearly and was just totally burned out. And a supervisor, Kath, later told this colleague that, you know, we really can't prove what happened and nothing else was done. So in response to the scandal, in 2024, Boulder District Attorney Michael Doherty said that the CBI previously informed his office that they reviewed the work related to Michael Clark's case, and the CBI determined there were no issues with Ms. Wood's analysis.
Shouldn't they bring in somebody else to check that out?
I know. And here's what's funny, Kath. The prosecutor in Michael Clark's case, Ryan Brackley, left the prosecutor's office and went into private practice, and he is now Ms. Woods' attorney.
As DA, wouldn't he have prosecuted a lot of the cases that she testified on? I mean,
yeah.
I know I haven't completed Killer Destination School of Law yet, but that just sounds sketchy to me.
That is
a good point. Do I go to the head of the class?
You totally go to the head of the class.
Yay!
So let's think about this. So if I'm a prosecutor, let me think about this. If
you're a prosecutor and you rely on this state employee analyst
to take the laboring oar in your cases
and
she's
do
later
the results,
yeah, and she's later
proved to be a big liar,
pants on fire for sure.
Can you then go back and be like, no, now I'm going to represent her because she was right the whole time?
I do not think there is technically a conflict of interest. However,
optics suck.
Oh, yeah, totally. It totally raises the appearance of impropriety because the implication is, here's the implication. I am now her lawyer. We have attorney-client privilege. And so I don't have to come clean on the bullcrap that
I know she did.
That I now know she did as she's telling me these secrets.
Right. Or
but
I might have known,
like,
at the time.
This is like, I really have to wrap my mind around this because
we don't have time.
Yeah, no, we don't.
Our listeners don't want to wait, but we'll wax poetic about it at some other time. But no, I mean, honestly, though, it does seem like
it smells bad.
It does.
On January 22nd, 2025, just a couple weeks ago, Missy Woods was charged with 102 felonies for allegedly altering and deleting data, skipping steps, and covering her tracks on criminal cases dating back decades. Included in the charges were 52 counts of forgery, 48 counts of attempting to influence a public servant. I would love to hear about that. Yeah. One count of perjury and one count of cybercrime. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation has acknowledged she worked on more than 10,700 cases during her nearly 30-year career as a state lab analyst. And a review of that work has so far uncovered 1,003 anomalies.
Has so far uncovered.
I know. I can't imagine what this lady's gonna... I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. So back to the former deputy district attorney, who is now Ms. Woods' attorney. He released a statement that said that Ms. Woods maintains that she has not offered false testimony in court and her work has not led to any false convictions or imprisonment.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
No harm, no foul.
Okay, thanks, Ryan.
Exactly.
Thanks, Ryan.
Bye-bye. He then continued to say, while the allegations resulting from the internal investigation point to Ms. Woods deviating from standard protocols and cutting corners in her work, she has long maintained that she's never created or falsely reported any incriminating DNA matches. Now, here's the thing. The fact that it was like an internal affairs for CBI who's doing this investigation, if they're saying this happened...
Oh, my God. It happened. It happened.
This isn't like news reporters who are reporting what they heard from colleagues or whatnot.
This is people like digging deep to get to the root of the problems in their own organization.
Exactly. Here's the other thing that just kind of killed me. And as we all know, I've been a public employee in the past. I worked for Congress for many years. One of the things that state employees and federal employees always want is a pension. Sadly, I didn't stay long enough to actually get a 30-year pension. But in 2024, when all this hit the fan, Missy Woods had worked for the CBI for 29 years, and she was allowed to resign in lieu of termination. What does that mean, Kathy?
I mean, she gets to keep her pension.
It was hard to get some of the data, but it looks like at the end of her career, she was making around $120,000 a year.
Yeah, that was without overtime.
And she did a ton of overtime, hundreds of thousands of dollars of overtime in the years that she had worked there. Which means, based on what we read, we believe that she's making anywhere from 75 to 90% of her salary as a pension every year for the rest of her life. Because she was allowed to resign in lieu of termination.
Maybe that's why the attorney took the case.
Because she can pay him.
He's like, you know.
I see you're coming into a little bit of cash and I don't think you're going to need it where you're going.
Is she married, you know?
I don't know.
Oh, her husband's like, thanks, honey.
You know what sucks about all this, Kath? This is America.
Yeah.
Love it or hate it, I dare you to find a better judicial system in the entire world. It is not perfect. It's not even great. But the fact is you can't go anywhere else. And yet this kind of stuff happens.
This is like disgusting.
For decades, it's ignored. It's pushed under the rug. It's a, you know what? It's fine.
Oh, she was tired or this or that.
Like, we don't want to go through the hassle it's going to create if we make her redo it. What if she sues? What
if she blah, were blah. Working for a private lab, Out. She would have been gone at the first mistake.
Exactly.
Didn't matter how tired she was or working overtime. Bye, sister. No, no, no.
Right.
That DNA was contaminated. Forget about it. We don't care that you were tired. This is life or death we're talking about.
Absolutely. Especially now,
everybody, all jurors expect is DNA connecting the bad guy to the victim. It is so unbelievably expected and relied upon.
Right.
And it's like those scientists have the keys to the kingdom, you know? And so
if this was just a circumstantial case without that DNA, there is no way that guy would have been convicted.
Not even close. None. No, it was pretty lame evidence.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but then his random like Carmex DNA, you know, yeah. I mean, so
you think about, we have 10,700 cases that could have been affected. All of these people, let's say they're all in prison. At what cost? To them, to their families, to their children, to society. You know, like all the money taxpayers have spent to incarcerate
the
these people.
The ramifications of one wrongly imprisoned person, it reverberates for generations.
Absolutely.
And I am not even kidding
about
that.
No, I know.
And for this woman to have done this, she was acting as though, I just did it in sex assault cases.
She was playing God.
What do you mean just sex assault cases? You know?
So Michael Clark, he had a wife and three young children when this happened.
Can you imagine?
So these kids have spent the last 12 years, one, thinking their dad killed someone, or, you know, hopefully not, but hearing that their dad killed someone.
Right.
And growing up without a dad.
Awful.
And what happened to the mom?
It's so awful.
Yeah. And $4.4 million to pay out cases seems like it needs to have a couple extra zeros after
that.
Totally.
That's a pittance.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting as they go through this, what is going to happen to the cases. And what's really sad, though, is that there are going to be cases that she actually probably did the right way. Doesn't matter. They all need to be thrown out.
It doesn't matter.
All of them out.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. You can't show that it's true.
No, you're going to.
This is a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace.
Yeah. Kathy, that's a really good point, because there are probably guilty people who are going to get out because of this.
Right.
So the Boulder County District Attorney and Michael's defense attorney agreed in late 2024 to let a Virginia Technology laboratory retest the DNA evidence in his murder case in light of the CBI scandal. And Michael's defense team has faced one delay after another. And at a hearing scheduled last month, prosecutors said the results of the retest may not come in until March, and the hearing on the evidence that could potentially overturn the conviction or grant a new trial is not scheduled until late May. So Adam Frank, Michael's attorney, expressed his frustration at the hearing, saying that what happened to his client is everyone's worst nightmare.
We will let you know as soon as any additional information comes out on this case, whether it has to do with Michael Clark or Missy Woods.
So thanks for listening.
Download.
Listen.
Delete. And hope everyone has a happy Valentine's Day.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today. Oh, oh.